Hey everybody, I'm Jerry. I'm probably the most disorganized alcoholic you have all ever met. I never know quite where I'm going to end up, and I spend time and I read and I prepare. I don't know if this is helping you, but it's great for me because I have to review these steps a lot. And then I get up here and whatever I plan, it just kind of goes out the window, you know, and I don't know where I start off and where I end up, but somehow we'll get there. And had some disturbing news. Carol asked me if I would speak on May 4th and can I stretch the steps, and I was thinking about how to do this and I decided yes, it can be done, and May 4th I'll talk about step 13, so we'll have a big crowd there. I have not practiced that step. Okay, what I like to do, there's a reason I wore the hat up here. It's one of my favorite hats. It probably needs to be cleaned and burned, not necessarily in that order. What I'd like to do is kind of review just a little bit, okay? And the basis for everything that comes after step one is step one. And I had a real hard time with this step. And you know, in the job that I do now, I can see myself all the time, over and over and over again, because I get to meet people that are coming in for evaluations for their first or second or 13th DUI. So I don't have a problem, you know, and I can relate to that because that's exactly where I was. What it talks about, you know, I started coming to AA meetings several years before I got sober, because all I was doing was coming to some meetings, and I was coming to some meetings for some wrong reasons. And I'll tell you some things that happened is that I would come to meetings because I needed to keep my job and I was in trouble with a job. I need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days and get a sponsor. So you don't know how busy I am. I focus on this job. I got to keep this job, and I start working more hours, slack off the meetings, and get drunk and lose the job, okay? And then we were going to lose the house because I lost the job, and I came back to AA and go to a lot of meetings, you know, at first. They say, come to 90 meetings in 90 days and get a sponsor and work the steps. And I said, yeah, but I'm going to lose this house if I don't get money and pay this back payments and all that stuff. And guess what happened? I quit going to the meetings, and I didn't get a sponsor, and I got drunk, and we lost the house, you know? And then the bride was getting ready to boot me out, right? And I got back into meetings again to keep the wife, you know, and started going to meetings. And she said, and you know, she didn't understand. She didn't go to Al-Anon right away. She says, "Why? How long are you going to have to keep going to those meetings? You know, why do you have to keep going to those meetings?" And I said, "Well, you know, they said go to 90 meetings in 90 days." She says, "You know, there's not a whole lot of difference. You weren't home when you're drinking, and you're not home now." Well, the difference was I was sober, but I didn't know how to calibrate. That's a big difference. So I, you know, the family's really important, and you know, she's getting upset. So I got to spend some quality time with the family. So I started slacking off the meetings, and guess what happened? I got drunk and I lost my wife and family for a while. Anything I put ahead of my sobriety, I lost. Today, my sobriety is a priority. It's not necessarily the most important thing, but it's a priority. I take care of it first, and it enables me to keep all those things. It's amazing. When I put my wife ahead of my sobriety, I lost the wife and kids. When I put the house ahead of it, I lost the house. When I put the job ahead of it, I lost the job. Now I put my sobriety first, and guess what? I have a job. Nobody's fired me in the last two or three weeks. Anyway, I have a job, you know. I haven't been fired from jobs. We don't own a house, but we've been living in the same place for 13 years. The most stable my kids have ever been, living in one place for 13 years. And the wife and the family were all back together again. Even the dogs got better. Okay? Those who were here last week understand what I'm talking about. But when I started coming around, I didn't really understand what was wrong with me. I thought that this was a matter of willpower and everything. And you guys tried to tell me something. You know, you said, well, the thing is, you got a disease, Jerry. A disease. And the way you try to explain it is, yeah, you got an allergy. Allergy. Yeah. Now, come on, I know what an allergy is. Yeah, you have an allergic reaction to alcohol. I'm allergic to the sun, for crying out. That's why I wear this hat when I wear the, I got these T-tops, and if I don't wear this hat, I get these little spots on my head, and I have to get them burned off, and it hurts like hell. But, so what do I do? I'm allergic to the sun. Guess what I do? I just don't go in the sun, okay? I don't need to go to meetings not to go in the sun. I don't have to wear steps not to go in the sun, and get a sponsor not to go in the sun. I just stay out of the sun. That's all. Real simple. But he said he had an allergy, and I couldn't understand what you meant. And then one time, I thought I understood what you meant, because, I'd gone, my wife had begged me not to drink too much at a Christmas party, and I didn't. I drank too much before the Christmas party. I mean, if you gotta go to a Christmas party, you gotta get a little loose first. You know, you just can't go and socialize without a little booze in you. And it was the Christmas party at my boss's house in Charlotte, North Carolina. And he was the vice president of a $200 million a year studio portrait firm. And all the executives were going to this Christmas party. And this was in Charlotte in the winter, so it was snowing, you know, and they wore coats. And the executives wore nice London fogs, and the wives wore their furs, and they piled all the coats into the spare bedroom on a spare bed. And what I did is I drank too much before the Christmas party, so I wanted to be of some service. I learned about being of service early, you know. So I started to tend the bar. You know how you tend a bar when you're an alcoholic? You know, one for you, one for me. One for you, two for me. One for you, three for me. And before the evening was over, I got a little tired. And I went to find some place to lay down. Well, I disappeared. So my wife starts asking around, have you seen Jerry? And I'm like, no, he was here a while. He was back tending bar, you know. Hold on. So she gets the boss's wife, and together they begin searching the house for me. And I remember the first thing I heard, see, they opened the door to the spare bedroom, and I had laid down on top of these nice fur coats and London fogs to take a little nap, okay? And in the process, I got sick, and then I rolled around it. Sorry about that. So I woke up to this boss's wife of mine screaming, get that pig out of my house, right? And you know me, leave now, the party's just starting, you know? Yeah, obnoxious, you know, all that kind of stuff. So they have to escort me out of the house. They have these two big, husky, you know, guys escort me out of the house. And then I'm insisting I'm going to drive. I'm fine, thank you very much, you know? So they have to put me into the passenger side and buckle me in, and my wife drives me home, bawling all the way because she's embarrassed and tears. Well, by the time we get to the house, get away, guess what happened? I'm sleeping peacefully in the front seat. You know, nothing wrong here. So she decides, she carries me inside and deposits me at this couch right inside the front door, you know. And I wake up in the morning on the couch. And my head hurt, which wasn't unusual. My stomach hurt, which wasn't unusual. But my head hurt to touch it. That's kind of unusual, you know. So I kind of went to the bathroom to splash some water in my face and looked in the mirror. And I had pock marks all over my head. I had broken out in these spots, you know? I mean, just big purple pock marks. I said, oh my God, look at this. And you really, I'm allergic to alcohol, breaking out in these spots. I'm really allergic. Look at this. And she came in, yeah, you better stop drinking. For years, I was sober. This was 2 years before I got sober, right? Or about a year before I got sober. I was sober 2 years before she ever told me what really happened, all right? 3 years after the event. She was so upset with me. Here she is. She's embarrassed to tears. I've embarrassed her in front of my boss and his wife and made a fool of myself. And she drags me into the house finally, and here's this drunk with this great balding dome, you know, resting on the arm of the chair, snoring away peacefully. She was so angry, she took off her high-heeled shoe and she's like, oh, she popped me all over the head with this heel of this high-heeled shoe. So I thought I knew what they meant when they said allergic to alcohol. Yeah, I'm going to doctors. Hey, doctor, have you ever heard of it? No, but you better not drink anymore. Going to alcohol. No, I have this reaction. So anyway, but I, you know, later I studied this disease of alcoholism. The thing I want to emphasize is it is a physiological disease. It is primary disease. It's a physiological disease. I learned some things that were very consistent with what Dr. Silkworth's theory was. And he had a theory that we had an allergic reaction to alcohol. That it was a craving. Once we put any alcohol into our system, we kicked off this craving. And the crazy part of it is, when we didn't have a craving and we didn't have alcohol in our systems, we had the obsession with the next drink. And that's where the insanity of step two kicks in. You see, the real insanity is not the crazy things we do when we're drinking, but it's picking up the first drink of the next series when we're not drunk, okay? And starting the whole process all over again. That's the real insanity of it. So he explained it. Well, since then, I've learned some things, and I found that alcohol in the body of an alcoholic does not break down normally. It forms a brand new chemical called THIQ, attaches to the new receptors in the brain. Operates just like morphine. Okay, this is not in the big book, but it's very consistent with the theory that Dr. Silkworth came up, which was very revolutionary at that time. Okay, And if he had known all this that we've since learned about alcoholism, I'm sure he would have put this in his doctor's opinion, because what he's saying is very consistent with it. So I know what you mean today. I have THIQ. Well, yeah, there's only one way to find out, and that is you got to cut open your brain, you know, and take some tissue out. And most people don't do this. I have people say, is there any kind of test? Well, yeah, you know, you can, you know, take a little tissue out. So when I say I have, I'm 99.999% positive I'm an alcoholic, all right? Imagine how embarrassed I'd be at my autopsy that cut up on my brain and no THIQ on me. What about the whole day? You come up and... But anyway, that's the basis of it. So I'm powerless. And where does the problem center? It centers between this year and this year, because that's where alcohol does its effect. It's on my brain, the obsession part of it. And once I take it in, the craving that sets in. The next thing is, if I'm powerless, I got to find another answer. So I came to believe in a power greater than myself. That's step two. And initially, for me, that power was you. I had to have something tangible, you know, something I could see that works. And it happened to, for me to be the group of alcoholics that I went to and a person identified as my sponsor early on, because they were obviously doing something I could not do for myself. Now I believe that God happens to work through you all, okay? And my higher power is God, as I understand it. But initially, I had to kind of take this thing a little bit, you know, kind of baby steps. Kind of like the movie, What About Bob? No. Baby steps, a little bit at a time. So if there is something bigger than me, the next obvious thing to do is to make a decision to turn myself over to it. And the action part of step three is making the decision. Obviously, the next thing is follow the directions, right? If I'm powerless and there's something bigger than me and they got an answer, right, what's the most obvious logical thing in the world to do? Follow their suggestions. And you guys write them down and you put them on walls and you put them in books and you call them 12 steps. Okay? And the first thing that we talk about doing is making an inventory. Now, steps four is making the inventory. Step five is admitting it to another human being, to ourselves, to God, and to another human being. We talked about that, how tough that is. And the reason we need to do it that way is, again, this problem centers between this year and this year. If I depend on me for the interpretation of what my problem is, and on me for finding the solution, I'm in deep trouble, because the problem is me. Okay? So I've got to begin to depend on some other people. Also, humility. Another word for humility is honesty. I used to get humility and humiliation all confused. Right? Humility is just admitting right up front what the deal is. Okay? Humiliation is getting caught. You know, when you're denying it. Okay? And that theme runs through our whole deal, our whole lives. Not just with alcoholism in denial, but with all our other character defects too. Okay? So what's the first step of getting into some recovery from my disease, which is inside me, is getting honest, getting real. And when I'm honest and I admit it, then I can't get humiliated, because I'm already admitting it up front. I don't know if that makes sense to you. Okay? Now, I brought the head up here for a reason. Step six separates the men from the boys. Separates the men from the boys. You know, and we kind of pass by this step, but I'll tell you something. The longer I'm around this thing, and the more I go through this practice of doing those last three steps, the more step 10 kicks me back into step 6 and 7. Okay? Because what am I dealing with? I'm dealing with the same character defects over and over and over and over again. And this program is kind of like swimming upstream in the St. John's River, you know? I got to kind of keep stroking. All right? I might rest for a little while, but the current, the natural current of my alcohol is going to start carrying me backwards. Some days I stroke and I get ahead a little bit. Some days I stroke and I just stay even with the current. Some days I stroke and I seem to fall behind. But if I stop stroking for too long of a period of time, what's going to happen is the natural current of my alcoholism is going to carry me back into that ocean of alcohol where I could drown. Okay? And the maintenance steps, step 10, one of the effects for step 10 for me is it keeps kicking me back into step 6 and 7. It keeps reminding me of these basic character defects that I believe are getting less over a period of time. Okay? I believe that they're not gone. but I don't act on them as much. They don't seem to have quite the control over my life that they used to. You ever do this? Think about this. How do we change, right? First, by change, you became aware something needs to be changed, right? So what is one of my main character defects? I would get angry. It talks about step four. Resentments is the number one offender. Man, I would fly off the handle at anything. And in my first year recovery, I put two holes in my, one in the wall and one in the door of my home. One's in the wall of the hallway, and one's on the inside part of the door of the our bedroom. I don't know if that tells you what's going on in our house. I thought it was recovery. You know, I said, this is improvement. I'm not hitting people. You know? Yeah. But it kind of tells you how crazy you can get still, you know, in all the character defects that are still there. It just after putting the plug in the choke. And it's still there. And I got kind of tired in working step 10 and going back and saying, honey, I'm sorry I lost my temper, you know, and honey, I'm sorry I yelled at the kids and so forth and so on. And you become aware of these things, and you say, geez, you know, it's kind of embarrassing, and I really hate to keep going back and apologizing for the same thing over and over again to the same people. And then it starts to hit you. You become ultra aware. You know, usually what happens in the beginning, you're aware right after you punch the hole in the wall, you yell at the kids. Kind of like Chris Farley yelled, get it again. It's all stupid. But after a while, you start to become aware as you're doing it, you know. You know, and you kind of you try to stop yourself, and sometimes you can, and sometimes you can't. You still go back and make a mess. And then after a while, what happens is you get to be aware of it right before you start doing it. Okay? The awareness keeps heightening and heightening. Anyway, they tied my hands, I wouldn't be able to talk. Right. But what they're talking about in step six is, they said step six is the difference between the men and the boys. It talks of becoming entirely willing to have God remove all of these defects of character. Entirely and all is a big order. And they do give us an out. They say what we are striving for is an ideal. We don't reach perfection. And I kind of go back to that in step seven when I'm going to talk about step seven. In step six, few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. We want to settle for only as much perfection as will get us by in life. And then in that typical of us, you know, that type of thing. And then it talks about the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between striving for a self-determined objective, as much as it will get me by, and for the perfect objective, which is of God. And you got to remember that this program originally came from the Oxford group, and they were talking about perfect humility and perfect honesty and perfect, you know, purity and so forth and so on. The alcoholics recognize we can't reach perfection, but we can strive towards those as ideals. And it always gives us something to shoot for because we'll never reach it. Okay. Step seven, then. Oh, and it also says, many of us ask, how can we accept the entire implication of step six? That's perfection. And it sounds like a hard question, but practically speaking, it is only step one, where we made 100% admission we are powerless over alcohol, can be practiced with absolute perfection. And the rest of them are stated as ideals that we strive towards. Okay? Step seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. You know, There is a lot behind step seven that doesn't meet the eye when you first look at it. What I mentioned before is, how do we change? You know, we ask God, and I'm going to go back a little bit. Bill Wilson got a lot of his ideas from the book by Henry James, The Variety of Religious Experiences. And what Henry James described in example after example after example and was able to extricate from this as kind of a theory of how people have these spiritual experiences, religious experiences, he called it, was, first of all, they're faced with a tremendous problem. And it presents a great deal of pain in their lives. And they struggle and they struggle and they struggle trying to overwhelm this problem with their own power. Okay, with their own willpower, and they repeatedly fail. And the struggle and the failure and the struggle and the failure and the struggle and the failure just gets to be so overwhelming that finally they get to a point where they surrender. And they give up, and they ask something bigger than them for help, and then they enter a period of peace. And amazingly enough, what happens is the very problem that seems so overwhelming just seems to kind of dissipate. It's not so big anymore. Even if it continues to be a problem, it's not as overwhelming as it once was. Okay? And that's kind of what happens to us as we work through these steps, especially steps 6 and 7. Humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. To remove our shortcomings. There's a prayer. It's called the 7-step prayer. I love this. And there's two prayers that I love in the Big One. One is the 3rd-step prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of self. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And you know, that's our whole problem, right? I'm living in my act of alcoholism. What am I doing? I'm acting like the center of the universe, right? And everything, the moon, the stars, the wife, the kids, the boss, everything's got to rotate around me, okay? And if you don't think this is true, go to a discussion meeting sometime. And look at your past participation, or maybe my past participation in a discussion meeting. Somebody will bring up a problem, right? I'll sit there and I'll say, oh, that's no problem. Blah, blah, blah. And if, because it doesn't concern me, I can be objective. I can sit back and say, well, here's what you do, you know, that type of thing. 2 weeks later, let the same thing happen to me, and what happens? Oh, God, what do you do? I mean, it suddenly becomes a big deal because it concerns me all of a sudden. You know, and that's just kind of a description of where I am. I'm still stuck in the center of that universe all the time. And we do that, and we see that repeatedly all over again. So I'm at the center of this universe, and what happens is, in these steps, I begin to try to remove myself out of the center of the universe, put God in the center of the universe where He belongs, and get out here with the rest of the people. You know, no better than, no worse than. Just about the same as. And what happens in the 7-step prayer, the 7-step prayer tells me a lot. It says, my Creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. Oh. So I'm not expecting perfection. So I recognize that God recognizes that there's a whole bunch to me, and not all of it's good. And I'm willing to give it to Him anyway. And it's okay. See, I used to think I had to get good before I could pray. And here it's saying, no, recognize it for what it is. You don't have to get good before you pray. Just give it to Him all, the good and the bad. So He doesn't expect perfection before I get to the step. I am now willing that you remove from me, that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And then the 12 and 12 talks about, you know, God doesn't just suddenly render us snow white. You know, that sometimes some of these things are not taken away instantaneously and overnight. And why is it? Well, for one thing, we don't seem to have quite the bottom with some of these character defects that we do with alcohol. You know, alcohol, our alcohol use was self-destructive. And it was destroying everything around us. It was destroying family, it was destroying ourselves. Somehow these other character defects, I have one I've been struggling with, Harvey knows, for a long time. And I haven't quite been able to, you know, quite get there yet. But I've never been arrested for smoking while driving or for smoking in disorderly conduct, okay? It's getting less, but it's still there, okay? And I recognize this is something I need to deal with. But it's not as life-threatening. It doesn't have quite the social consequences. But, although they're getting tougher with it now, socially. You know, it's getting to be more and more unsocially acceptable, unacceptable behavior. So anyway, I'm working on that one. But most of our character defects are not quite as, they're not life-threatening, supposedly, I hope. And they're not quite as life-threatening. Well, some of them could be. But, like my anger. My anger could be life-threatening. There is something like this happen. I'm driving my first car in sobriety, my Dempsey Dumpster Mobile, a 1984 Chevette. Chevette. I mean, this thing, you couldn't get it more than 55 miles an hour unless you grease the front end and push it off the cliff with a tailwind. And I'm driving, you know, where a 295 kind of goes into one lane and gets into I-95 as you're going north on I-95 from Mandarin 295. I'm coming around that corner, and here's this dump truck coming up beside me, all right? And this guy forces me off the road. I mean, it just comes right over into my lane, you know? And what's my first reaction? Same as it always was, right? My instantaneous reaction was fear. You know, I get out of this guy's way. And the next thing, instantly replaced with anger. They're trying to kill me, you know. So what do I do? I go right back into my old, this is 3 years in the recovery, mind you. Go back right into my old behavior, I got all 3.5 cylinders just fine. You know, what am I going to do? I'm going to catch up to this drunk truck and I'm going to force him off the road. In a Chevette, right? I can just imagine his ramp. Boom, boom, what was that? Oh, it's just a Chevette. But anyway, I can't catch up to him because the Chevette just doesn't go that fast, right? On 3.5 cylinders. But anyway, as I'm driving along, I'm starting to dawn on me, wait a minute. This is kind of stupid. I'm going to run a dump truck off the road, and then I begin to reevaluate. Well, what do you think really happened, Jerry? Did he really try to run you off the road on purpose? Well, no, probably. I was in his blind spot. He probably just pulled over and, back off the gas and slow down to 35. Whatever it's going to do. But my initial reaction is the same initially in the beginning, and I have to work at it to start backing that process up. Now somebody starts going into my lane, I'm more likely to back off and God bless you and, go injure somebody else or whatever you're going to do and let them go. Well, you know what? I was rushing to a meeting once with my first sponsor. We were running late and I had picked him up and we're zipping in and out of traffic and I'm telling him, I'm thinking of getting a bumper sticker. And he says, that's interesting. What are you thinking of getting? And I said, Easy does it. And he says, great. He said, put it on your dashboard. You're the one that sees it, not the guy behind you. So anyway, I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you, my fellows. Grant me strength as I go up from here to do your bidding. Now, there's a couple of things that tells me, okay, that a lot of the work that's going to be involved is God's going to do it if I let him. Now, there's a certain amount that I have to do, that I have to be willing to do. But if I let him, if I humbly ask him to remove it, I have to do some groundwork. But really, if it's going to be removed, he's the one that's going to remove it. My job is to till the soil and get it right. And there's certain things that I can do to kind of continue doing that. The other thing that tells me is when I ask for strength, as I go up from here to do your bidding, it means that it might not be what I want to do, okay? What the old me wants to do. And I might need something extra from outside of me to help me do what the right thing is. And that's kind of humbling to think in those terms, okay, to have that happen. But that means a lot to me. That seven-step prayer means a lot to me in terms of how we go about these changes and asking him to remove these character defects. And if we continue to practice the rest of the steps, especially the maintenance steps, where a continuation of this, that's going to happen to a certain degree automatically. When I first started coming around AA, all right, I was known as Jerry the Hat. Okay. And this kind of tells you, I'm telling you the story because it kind of tells you about how we are on the inside, okay? You might say I was a little embarrassed about having slightly receding hairline. I got two hairs up there and both 83 feet long, But having a slightly receding, so I'd wear a hat, right? And, I've always been this way my whole life until fairly recently in terms of my life. When I started going bald, it really bothered me. And then I had to hurry up and meet some sweet young thing that would marry me before she realized I was going bald. Is that a con job? I mean, is it just like a con job? And then I went bald right after I met her and blamed it on her. It's your fault. And she believes it. I mean, talk about a good Al-Anon, right? So then what do you start doing next? Then I start growing these three hairs that are 83 feet long and kind of wrapping them around over here, Kind of like the old 1959 buns that the ladies used to wear. Except mine is just, I'm trying to get it flat and going over here. Self-conscious in extreme, right? And that doesn't work, all right? Because sometimes you might open the window when the car's going down the road and, one of them goes outside and the truck runs over. Oh, my God! So it becomes very awful. Then I try a few hay, okay? And neighbor's dog chased me around the block, but a tree to raccoon. I thought, well, I got to do something about this. I tried growing a beard. I could put hair someplace, maybe a little bit. Then people thought I was wearing my head upside down. I had to shave it off. But I went into a meeting at the San Marco Club, and I would wear this hat to the meeting, and I'd wear it in the meeting. And my nickname when I got sober was Jerry the Hat. Okay. Now, that wasn't as bad as Jerry the Nose. There was another guy named Jerry the Nose. I won't tell you what he looked like.
Self-conscious about that. I said, well, you know, I can't wear this hat in the meeting, so I would wear the hat to the meeting, and then I'd take the hat off during the meeting, and then as soon as the meeting was off, put the hat back on, you know, and go outside. And then I still stuck. The name still stuck. So I decided, well, I won't wear the hat to the meeting. And I walked into the San Marco Club one day, and you know how they have these chairs behind you as soon as you walk in the door and you can't see who's sitting over there? Well, I'm walking back towards the snack bar, and this guy yells out, hey, Baldy! I'm just turn, beat, run, walk, talk, turn around, order, you know. And here's this guy, I mean, you think I'm bald. Here's this guy, all you had to do was kind of put shoe polish on his head, and he looked like a bowling ball, you know? I mean, totally, not a single hair, and big smile. And I looked at him and I said, am I stupid or what? I mean, I'm acting stupid about this thing. And I began to look at that. And you know what it was? Here I am, denial about a physical trait. Trying to cover it up, trying to deny it, getting embarrassed, getting mad, all this crazy, crazy activity around a physical trait, right? And you know what I do now? Obviously, I seem to accept it better and joke around about it. Okay? No big deal. Actually, you know, all those full-headed guys can wish their hormones on anything you want, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, we joke around about it now. It's no more big deal. And I don't have to wear a beard anymore. Although I do see some nice-looking beards and mustaches in here, and even some of the men have some on. What's the very next thing that happens after? You know, a lot of times we think that we invented this thing. I read something one time that to me it was significant. I just happened to run across it. I cut it out and I put it someplace and I couldn't find it for the meeting. But this is not an exact quote, but I'm going to try to paraphrase it as best I can. And it's from St. Paul in the New Testament in one of his letters. Because we think we invent a lot of this stuff, right? So that I might not become conceited, I was given a tribulation, a thorn in the flesh, to beat me and keep me from becoming proud. Three times I begged the Lord that this might be removed from me. But the Lord said to me, be content. My grace is enough for you. For in weakness, power reaches perfection. So now I boast of my weaknesses instead. And I am content to bear persecution, disappointments, and trials for the sake of Christ, so that the power of God may rest upon me. For it is when I am powerless, it is then that I am strong. And we think we invented this stuff. You know, a lot of these concepts, a lot of these precepts were there long before AA came along. I think what AA did is kind of got into this. And that's kind of what happens in step 7. When we admit our weaknesses and we depend upon a higher power, then it seems to be that our strength comes through. And you know, all the time that I'm denying this, and we go through this phase of denial, of struggle, of denial, of resistance, with something that just seems to be overwhelming, then get frustrated with it, and then surrender, and turn it over, and then it's okay. Over and over and over and over again. And I do it with the alcohol, and then I get done with the alcohol, and I find that I got to do it with this character. And then I got to do it with this over here, and I do it with this over here. And it keeps on. But what happens is, the more I do it, just as the alcohol today is no longer a problem. Okay? I want it to continue to not be a problem, that's why I keep working on other things. But today is no longer a problem. Some of the other things are going to be less and less intense and cause fewer problems and become aware of them sooner and able to kind of head it off sooner. But that is kind of where step 7 works. And I think step 7 is so closely connected to the other steps that it's really hard to separate them out. As I mentioned, step 10 keeps kicking me back into it. You know, I said I was going to get to step 8 tonight, but I got to go to May 4th anyway, right? Right? Is that okay? I got to go to May 4th anyway. There's this is a lifelong job. And the most, you know, I used to think courage was standing up to somebody. You know, if they dared put me down, like turning around to the guy that called me, hey, Baldy, I used to think that was courage, standing up to somebody and fighting. Right? And when I look at it now, really the most courageous men I have ever met in my life are not the guys that fight when they're confronted with something they don't like, maybe about themselves. The most courageous people are not really, they're not firemen, they're not cops, they're not fire pilots. To me, the most courageous men that I have met are the men that have looked at the man in the glass and gotten real honest about it. And there was, I mentioned before that I do a training on an instrument that's used in assessing alcoholism. There's one score on that. There's several scores, and they work together. One score is called DEF, and it's a defensiveness scale. And typically, when a person is new in recovery or in denial, they have a very high DEF scale score. And when they're brand new in recovery, they have a very low DEF score. And when they're kind of getting along okay and they've been around for a while, it kind of averages out. Well, if you look at it, that's kind of look in the mirror, okay? And what a person sees is not what's really there. Now, if you can imagine this, me looking in the mirror, and a very high DEF score would be Robert Redford, move aside. Okay, you know, that type of thing. I just kind of an unrealistically high portrait of myself that kind of, you know, blots out all the blemishes, and it's very unrealistic. And everybody else looks at me and says, who's he kidding anyway, right? I mean, and that's kind of the way we are when we're in denial with our alcoholism, and that's also the kind of way we are when we're in denial regarding some of our character traits. Okay? The other one is the one that happens when you first become aware of your alcoholism and all the consequences, and it's a low DEF, and it's kind of like the guy looks in the mirror and says, oh my God, look at this, I'm bald, I got bags in the eye, sagging, and I'm overweight, and oh, somebody just take me out and shoot me, you know, I'm no good for anything. And it's kind of the way sometimes people come into recovery, where they all of a sudden they're hit with the reality of what is, and it's just overwhelming at first. But that's not really a realistic picture either. And step seven, that prayer says, I'm now willing you should take all of me, the good and the bad. It means there's some good in there too. Okay? Well, after we've been around for a while, we look in the mirror and we get kind of a very real assessment of ourselves. And I can see this happen when I administer this questionnaire to people. If they're in denial, the DEF score is way up there. Nothing wrong with me. If they're brand new in recovery, they just got a detail, and if they've been for around for a few years and been working the program, they get a very realistic picture of themselves. Well, yeah, Jerry, sure, you're bald, you got, you know, a few bags under your eyes and some wrinkles, but you're 51 years old, what the hell do you expect? Okay? I mean, it's okay. You're about average for that. And if you want to improve a little bit, maybe you could go on a diet or whatever, you know, that type of thing. But a very realistic picture of ourselves. And what happens is when we come around for a while, we begin to get more and more and more of a realistic picture of ourselves. Because when we get into step seven, it also says we're not trying to beat ourselves into the ground necessarily. We don't be too hard on ourselves, but we don't want to be too easy on ourselves either. And I think it's one of the reasons why it's so important to have a sponsor in going through these steps. Because the least qualified person to assess myself is me. Okay? If I got somebody else that's been around for a while and has seen both sides of this whole spectrum and can look at me objectively and say, Jerry, here's the deal. And he's not that far off, by the way. Most often, he is not that far off. In fact, he's very rarely far off at all. And I used to say, how in the world does he know me so well? And then since then, I've had people say that to me. How in the world do you know me so well? I don't know them. When I'm talking to them about them, I'm not talking to them about them. I'm talking about what's going on and what had gone on here. I happen to know how I was and what was going on with me. And when they can relate to it, that's about the only difference. And I used to wonder how Ed knew me so well. And as time goes on, we get to know ourselves better and better. We begin to accept ourselves more and more. And look in the mirror and not smash it with a fist. And, you know, okay, we're going to be all right. You know, we're going to wake up tomorrow. There's not going to be a white chalk line around our body. The sun's going to come up, and the grass is going to be green, and the sky's going to be blue, and it's going to be okay. Okay. I I think I'm, what I'm going to do, I will end up on a step this week, if that's all right. With your permission. And next week, get into 8 and 9. And they're very closely connected. And I'll probably do a lot of those together. Because it's hard for me to talk about making the list without getting into the amends. I will mention this, that there's sometimes there's some amends that you start making when you first get into recovery. And my sponsor had me start making one to my wife and family. You got to remember, we had been separated for 8 months or 6 months when I got into recovery. And they were in North Carolina living off relatives' charity. Okay, because we had lost the house and my parents were renting a house and her parents were sending up food. And my sponsor says, your first job is to get a job. So he helped me get a job. And he says, your next job is to send whatever you don't absolutely need to live on up to the wife and five kids. And you know what my response was? Why? They're never coming back. I mean, I'm still a sip cookie. My response was, why? They're never coming back. Still in that self-centeredness, that selfishness. And then looked me square in the eye and he says, because it's the right thing to do. That's why. And if you're going to get sober, Jerry, you're going to do things for no other reason than because it's the right thing to do instead of what's in it for me. By this time I had become somewhat willing. So I started sending checks up to this lady in North Carolina who kind of waved at me with out all her fingers when she was waving goodbye. And was on the phone to the police for good reason, as it turns out. And she gets, here she had heard from me about 6 months, right? And she gets this check and this letter in the mail, and what's her reaction? Right. You know, so she deposits it, right? And she waits 10 days, because she's not going to write a check again. Before the first one clears, she gets a second one. Well, wait a minute, you know. So she deposits that. She's going to wait for that one. Meantime, the first one clears. It's good. And then she gets, before the second one clears, she gets a third one. After 2 months of that, she looked and said, there's something different. You know? I mean, this is a guy who couldn't support us when he lived here. And all of a sudden, he's sending checks up here, and they're not bouncing. Something's different. And that's when she called me up, and she says, I must be crazy. And she was. You know, I must be crazy, but let's try it again. You know, okay, you know. Hey, can I do this? He says, sure. You know, by that time, he had confirmed me enough on my feeble attempts at 13 steps that I figured that wasn't going to work. So I was going to get some sweet yam thing and help her. Wrong, Gary. You know, come on over here, boy. You know, that type of thing. He confirmed me on that early. So anyway, I couldn't get away with that. So the next best thing was. Let's get the wife and the kids back. And I'll tell you what, it has been... No, I mean, I shouldn't have said it that way. Some of this stuff is on tape. I mean, the best thing that could have happened would be for us to get back together. Because I'll tell you what happened is she got into the Al-Anon program and it forced me to get more into honesty also. All right. When she got into honesty, it's a wonderful program. And when two of them are working them together, it's amazing what can happen. And it's not fun all the time, but it is growth. And if you hang with it long enough, it can be some real neat experiences. Love you all, and a damn thing to do about it.